Did you know that I wrote a book?
I did.
Momentum, Creating Effective, Engaging, and Enjoyable Meetings. One of the responsibilities that often comes with being a manager is leading meetings. And most of us, myself included, were never taught how to do this thing that takes up so much of our weeks. So if you're ready to level up your meeting skills so you can spend less time in bad meetings and transform the meetings you do have into powerful conversations, check out my book, Momentum, available on Amazon, or download the first chapter for free at meteor.com/momentum. meteor.com/momentum. We know that the world is constantly changing and that living with so much uncertainty takes its toll. What's not so obvious is the strategies that we've developed as individuals and a team for navigating that instability and uncertainty that comes with modern life. But with a little intention, there's actually a lot we can do to help our people and ourselves find solid footing despite the shifting environment. A warm welcome to Matt C. to the Modern Manager community. Today's guest is Ashley Goodall. Ashley is a leadership expert who has spent his career exploring large organizations from the inside, most recently as an executive at Cisco. He is the co-author of 9 Lies About Work, which was selected as the best management book of 2019 by Strategy and Business, and as one of Amazon's best business and leadership books of 2019. Prior to Cisco, he spent 14 years at Deloitte as a consultant and as the chief learning officer for leadership and professional development. His book, The Problem with Change, publishes this coming May. Ashley and I talk about the challenges of constant change and the impact it has on us and our team members. He also shares how managers can use rituals to create a sense of certainty and stability. And hint, it's not just useful during times of change. And in the extended interview available to members of Podcast Plus, Ashley shares a massive finding from his research on how managers can create predictability as leaders, as well as how language plays an important role. Now here's the conversation. Are you a manager, boss, or team leader who aspires to level up and unleash your team's full potential? You're listening to the Modern Manager Podcast, and I'm your host, Mamie Canfer-Stewart. Each week, I explore effective strategies and provide actionable insights that supercharge your management abilities, optimize team performance, and foster a healthy workplace culture. Become a rockstar manager and help your team thrive at themodernmanager.com/more. Thank you so much for joining me today, Ashley. I was just saying how much I enjoyed reading your book, and I'm super excited to dive into this topic of change and how we as managers can navigate this kind of constant world of change that we are finding ourselves living in professional contexts, and where just all the stuff that comes with that, all the problems that come with it, and some of the solutions you lay out that we can start to help ourselves and our team members get some solid grounding in our workplaces. So thank you for joining me.
It's wonderful to be here.
What is this problem we have right now with change, where it's like constantly things are just never stable anymore? Can you kind of just give us some grounding around what is happening in the world right now, especially in the workplace where there's just constant changes happening?
The book is an attempt to say, okay, what's behind all the constant change, and is it actually as good as everybody claims it is? The conflict, if you like, that we start with, maybe conflict is a bit of a strong word, but the tension is that if you listen to the sorts of people who run organizations, or the people who advise the people who run organizations, or the people who evaluate the people who advise the people who run the organization, all of those folks, if you listen to all of them, they will say change is a jolly good thing. If they're not British, they might not say a jolly good thing. They'd say something, but they'll say change, this change stuff, fantastic. The more the better. In fact, our jobs as leaders is to make change and more of it and more of the time, because change is always up and to the right in life. But if you go and talk to the people on the receiving end, the people on the front lines of organizations, the people who show up every day trying to do a job, they will say to you, it's too much. It makes it hard to do what I am trying to do. I mean, I know what my company needs me to do, and I'm trying to do these things, but it is very hard to operate in an atmosphere of ongoing uncertainty and lack of control, and where the teams keep getting jumbled up, and where I'm not sure what the point of my job is from one day to the next, because everybody keeps changing the rules. And so we have this bizarre situation, if you like, where the top of organizations are making as much change as they can and spinning the change flywheel as fast as they can. And the people at the bottom are going, stop it. Stop. Stop it. I can't do the work now because it's just too difficult to figure out which way is up or whether I'm having any impact in the world. And so the problem with change is it doesn't lead to improvement. That's the problem.
I mean, that's a very bold statement. And also, I think most people's live reality that we try to make positive changes, but they don't often lead to the outcomes that we anticipate. And I'll just say, you know, I don't run a very big organization. It's just me and two other team members. And I have to hold myself back from constantly wanting to make changes. Like, ooh, let's try this new system for our task management. It's going to be so much better and it will solve all these problems. And my one colleague, I told her, I was like, you have to hold me accountable to not changing platforms because I am one of those people that there is always something better if we just keep trying new things, keep changing our strategy, launching a new program. And it's true that if I look back, they have not all panned out the way that I believed they would. And I can only imagine inside of a large organization how disruptive that can feel when things are constantly being shifted underneath you.
Well, the lesson from what you just shared is that change and improvement aren't the same thing.
Yes.
And that change doesn't necessarily imply improvement. Obviously, most of us know that for something to be better, it's got to be different from how it is now. So we're in the ballpark, I suppose. There's a lot of decision making in large organizations that isn't particularly well informed by what it's like on the front lines. And so what seems like a nice new shiny, what was your example, task management system?
Yeah.
It's like, well, that'll be great, won't it? And everyone's like, well, I just learned the last one. Hang on. Now I've got to learn this thing. It's going to take a week or a couple of days or whatever. And those are 2 days that you never get back. And is it really worth that? And even if in one case that might be true or it might be necessary, if then next week there's another thing and then the following week there's another thing and then the following week there's another thing, pretty soon people stop investing their energy and attention in their jobs, which is not, you know, what leaders actually are trying to achieve with all of the change. So it is counterproductive, I think.
Yeah, it reminds me of the flavor of the week concept that I've heard from some managers. It doesn't matter what I bring to my team, they're just going to look at it and say, this is the new flavor of the week. Let's just wait a week and then it'll be gone and there'll be a new flavor of the week. And, you know, and that is definitely not the type of engagement that we want from our team members.
No, and of course, just to jump to the advice portion here, if your team is saying, we think this is the flavor of the week, then the advice would be, don't have a flavor this week. Keep the flavor from last week and try it on for a little bit longer. But, you know, what's interesting is that even in that little example, we teach people what to expect in the work environment. And people are smart and people are really good observers of their work environment. And so if you make a lot of changes and you don't stick the course on some of them and you're forever tweaking, sooner or later, people will stop paying attention to each one and they'll go precisely, well, it's just like, I just tune out for a week and then I'll get the next one that comes along next Monday and I don't need to pay attention.
And that is just as big of a problem, I think, as the one you mentioned in your book too, which is we jump on a change and then we never stop to reevaluate whether or not this change is still worth pursuing. Can you chat about that a little bit?
Well, I think one of the hardest things for a leader actually is to think better of something. I mean, the condition of being the leader of a team or the leader of an organization or leader of a function, that condition is, it's very hard to know whether you've done the right thing, but it's also at the same time a situation in which you feel that you need to put a best face on things and that people need you to be in some way strong and clear and consistent. And so there are all these sort of things that swim into your head when you become a leader. And very low on that list is have second thoughts about something. Very low on that list is to say to everybody, you know what, we tried this for a little while and it doesn't work. My bad, as you were. Like, the number of leaders who have the courage and the integrity to ever take something back, undo something, is vanishingly, vanishingly small. And it's partly because the world, or it's partly because if I make you a leader, you bring a whole bunch of your own expectations. And some of the expectations you might well bring to that role are that I need to be right about stuff. Mm-hmm. I need to be infallible. And so I can't go around changing course the whole time just based on things aren't going very well. I think, obviously, given that I've written half a book about this, the world would be a better place if leaders had the courage to turn around once in a while and go, this isn't working. There's a light version of this that you do run across where leaders go, this isn't working, so we're having a course correction, which is code for my change didn't work, so I'm going to have another change on top of that change. But I think it's vanishingly rare, as I said, that people go, you know, this isn't working. Never mind, as you were. Or this isn't working. Hey, team, what would you have done to remedy this problem before I clumped all over the place and made a big mess of things? A little bit more humility from leaders would go a long way to alleviating some of these sorts of problems that we're talking about.
Well, before we get to some of the other ideas and suggestions that you have for how we can navigate and support our teams when we're in this environment of change, can you talk a little bit about the toll that change puts on people and the challenges that we experience when we're in that kind of constant state of change?
One of the funniest things that strikes you as soon as you start pushing into this topic of change, the first thing that you meet is that everyone thinks it's great, or the leaders at least. The second thing is, if you go and look at the effects of change on the human psyche, you find that almost all negative. So psychologically, change is really hard on humans. It's not like change is basically psychologically good, but sometimes it's not. It's like basically the things that change visits on somebody are very hard for people to deal with. There are a few different flavors of sort of psychological difficulty. One is that, of course, as soon as I say, hello, everybody, I'm going to make a change, then what immediately happens is something called uncertainty. Uncertainty, there's all sorts of science about how uncertainty is very hard on people and causes all sorts of stress and actually physical health problems even. The second thing that happens when I say, I'm going to make a change, is that I'm reminding you that you actually don't have any control, and lack of control is very, very hard on humans. The most famous, I suppose, or one of the most famous experiments in terms of control was done in the 1960s by Martin Seligman, and led to the phrase, or the phenomenon of learned helplessness, where in fact, if I keep reminding you that you don't control any outcome, sooner or later you stop trying to exert any control over your environment. In other words, you phone it in. I don't know, what do we read about today? We read about the great resignation and quiet quitting and laser girl jobs and coffee badging and all of those things. They're all different phrases for phoning it in.
Yeah.
And I think it's not hard to connect the lack of control that people feel over their work environment with all of these trends, if you like, for sort of phoning it in. There's uncertainty, there's control. Then of course, the next thing that happens when I say, hello, everybody, I'm making a change, is you imagine I'm going to change the teams and change the social structures at work. And often, of course, in a reorg or a firing or any sort of thing that moves people from jobs to jobs to jobs, what you are doing is changing teams. And as I hope we'll talk about in a little bit, teams are an enormous source of stability at work and an enormous source of support for us all. So if you're going to shred the teams, then you're not helping people do the work that you need them to do. Connected to team is a sense of place. Humans love place. They love ritual in place. So we all have a morning routine, or many of us do. And you have little routines at work which connect the sort of rhythm of a day and a particular place or set of places. Those things get ripped up pretty quickly as soon as you set out on some big change initiative. And the last one is that it's very hard for people to make sense of their jobs when things are constantly changing. And we are sense makers, as the human animal is a big sense maker. We love stories. Stories help us comprehend the world and understand how the world relates to us. And if you show up at work on a Monday and somebody says, well, actually, your department is no longer about this, but it's about this. You're like, well, the story changed. Hang on. Does that mean that I'm no longer? Where's my thing in all of that? I don't know what my work means anymore. And that's really hard on us too. So you look across that was sort of a little bit of an answer there. But if you look across those things, if you look at uncertainty, control, belonging on a team, our identification with place and ritual and our sense of meaning, those all go pretty quickly out of the window when we launch a change initiative. And those are all essential to human health and contribution.
And I'm imagining that one solution could be, well, we just don't initiate changes anymore, but that's probably unrealistic to some extent. I'm wondering, especially about this role of team, since, you know, people who are listening are in roles of managers, which could be of a small team or could be a department or could be an entire organization. Can you talk a little bit about the role of the team in creating stability, in creating a sense of meaning or continuity, so that if change is thrust upon you by your organization, like, what is it that managers actually have influence over, that, and how can we kind of support our team members to not have so much uncertainty and so much feeling of lack of control and less sense of belonging and all those problems that you just mentioned? Hey there, Mamie here. Just a quick and exciting update for all of you who are enjoying the Modern Manager podcast. The Modern Manager membership community is getting a minor makeover, and it is now called the Podcast Plus membership. And you can sign up for it and join a community of managers determined to do better every day. You'll get full access to our Slack channel, sketch notes with key takeaways from each episode, all types of guest bonuses, and the members-only podcast, which is ad-free and has extended interviews. So you get to hear the answers to my juiciest questions without interruptions like this one. Sign up today for $15 per month at themodernmanager.com/more. Can't wait to see you there.
I'm not sure we're ever going to have none change. I'm not sure we should, because improvement does come from change, but also unimprovement comes from change. I'm just arguing we should think twice about it. We should have a higher bar, and that if we were aware of how hard it makes people to do the work that we've hired them to do, we might think harder about it. The lovely thing about teams is they are the home of stability in so many different ways, because when you join a team, you sort of quickly figure out that the other people are not you, and they can do things that you can't do. And so now you're plugged into this sort of little orchestration of differing abilities. And so you can get help and you can help others in return. And even that sense that I can benefit from skills that I don't myself have is a little bit of stability, if you like. Because now if we need somebody to write the advertising copy or the marketing copy for such and such, but I'm not great at doing that, but I've got a teammate who can, and I can just design the cadence of the campaign, then great. Okay. Now we are a little bit stronger in ourselves because we have more collective ability that we can deploy against the world. And we're also a little bit insulated against the change of somebody saying, you lot can't do X, so we're going to create a change, and people will come in who can do whatever the thing is. Teams at work are home for many, many, many sort of stability-making things, and team leaders can do a super important job in creating stability for people. Not always in response to change, by the way, but in anticipation of change. And this is the trick about the stability management game, if you like. You have to be doing it the whole time, because you don't always control when the change arrives. And so you want to give people an environment that bolsters them, if you like, against change. So some of the things are get to know your teammates, understand what your strengths are, understand what their strengths are, understand where you can help one another. Build rituals into the week of a team. And I don't mean incense and chanting. I mean, have things that happen predictably every Monday or every Friday, or have a way to start the day together, or have a way to end the day together. There was one I discovered, a team in the pandemic that had been co-located and was now all working from home, missed their team ritual, which was that as everybody left the office for the day, they would walk down the corridor and shout out, "I'm heading out, see you all tomorrow." And this couldn't happen because they were no longer in an office. So they created a team space just for doing that. There was some room on Slack or whatever that was called the corridor. And then as you left your home office for the day and went off to, you know, get the kids from school or feed the dog or cook the supper or whatever, you would just post in the room, heading out for the night, see you all tomorrow. And they virtualized this thing because it was so important to them to still have that ritual that closed a day for a group of people working together. And there's something so beautiful in that. It's simple, but it's human. And you hear about it and you just want to smile. Yeah. You're like, God, I want to be on the team that thinks about those sorts of things and has some slightly kooky way of doing it, because it matters to them so much that they've created a ritual to close out the day. So rituals on teams are really, really important things. Most teams have them, by the way. Most teams have a few. Most leaders have a few. The question is, do you know what they are? And are you guarding them, if you like, jealously enough? Because it takes a while to build them. You can't, one instance of anything isn't a ritual. One instance is a one-off. So it takes a while to build them. But the question for leaders is, do you know what they are? And has your team shaped them over time? And are you honoring them going forwards?
With rituals, do they have to be organic? Like, I imagine as a team leader, if I said, all right, folks, we're going to try this thing called the corridor that I heard about, right? It can feel kind of weird or awkward, or like, you know, your team members are rolling their eyes at you, like, really? So do the best rituals come from the things that we organically or naturally are already doing, and we maybe with a little more intention then shape them or solidify them into that kind of consistent usage? Or can we actually just start a new ritual by saying, we're starting a new tradition, we're starting a new practice, we're starting a new ritual? And if we're doing it that, are we then making it worse because we're actually introducing a change. Getting all of that, that right. Fun stuff?
Yeah. So your question is, if you change the rituals, is that stability or change? To which the answer is yes, by the way, just somewhat annoyingly. The funny thing about rituals is they come in all shapes and sizes. And one of the things that's very tricky is landing a very consistent definition of ritual. And the people who, there are researchers, by the way, there are scientists who study rituals. And I think if I were not writing books about change, I would actually want to be a ritual researcher, because it's all sort of completely fascinating stuff. But one of the things that's hard for the scientists is coming down to a definition in terms of, is it generated by the team? Is it generated by the leader? Is it built by the company? Is it? Because the answer to all of these questions seems to be yes and all of the above. The defining characteristic of a ritual is actually that it allows us to control our feelings in some way. They're emotional regulators. And any sort of thing that, it's a little circular, feels ritualistic and allows you to regulate your emotions in some way. So you want to have a calm feeling at the end of the day, so you have the corridor room. That's emotional regulation in one sense. So anything like that is a ritual. All sorts of good ones bubble up from teams. So teams will decide of them, you know, of their own volition, there will always be the morning coffee run. Mornings, for some reason, are very dense with rituals. There's a lot of morning stuff, fewer evening things. But so teams will decide, well, we're going to do this, or we're always going to have some silly thing. There was one team I discovered where two of the people would come in fancy dress every Halloween, and it was always two characters that were related to one another. So it was Batman and Robin would be the Halloween thing. And I don't think a leader thought of that. That sort of bubbled up from the team. It's a silly thing. But, you know, it's Halloween. And it's just a way of sort of marking the passage of time. And again, saying to people, this is the place still. You're still here. You're still in this. This is still recognizable as the place you come every day and the humans you work with every day. I had another leader who instigated a ritual, and it was actually on Monday. We'll go around the team and see if anyone wants any help this week from their teammates. And on Friday, we'll go around the team and see if anyone wants to thank somebody for help given during the week. So it was this beautiful bookend, Monday through Friday, that was all about this team will support one another, which in itself is a source of stability. And then the ritualization of support is another source of stability. And this team leader came up with that. She invented it. She told everybody this was what we were going to do. It took quite a few weeks before folks got comfortable with it. So it takes a little while for the whole thing to sort of gel. At the beginning, people said, well, I'm not going to show up on Monday and tell you where I need help with my work because it makes me look like I can't do my job. So I'm not, that's not how I'm going to start my week. But she kept going. And some brave people said, I could use a hand with this. And then on the Friday, somebody got thanked for helping somebody with the, and the whole thing began to generate its own momentum and over time became the signature of her team. And they were known as the team that was fantastic at supporting one another and the team that could handle all sorts of unexpected things, because whenever an unexpected thing came along, they could form quickly the right group of people to work on it. So it's some bubble up, some come from leaders, some come from countries, for goodness sakes. I mean, back where I grew up, there's a thing called the state opening of parliament. That's a ritual. We put a monarch in a chair and they read things. And apparently that helps the country be what the country is. It's some of them are weird. In terms of what is this for? Some of them, the connection between cause and effect is murky. But if you try and take them away, people get really annoyed. And that's one, again, back to some of the downsides of change. If you are removing the groups that had the rituals, then people lose the rituals and people lose that little ability to have some sort of emotional regulation in their working week, in a world where emotional regulation is kind of a nice thing to get a bit more of.
I never really thought about that, of rituals as a way to regulate our emotions or to bring us to a specific place or perspective that might come from completing that ritual, right? There's like the daily planning ritual that I have is, I think of it as being a productivity ritual that's about getting to the other side so that I have my day planned. But I also see now that it's about removing the anxiety of worrying about what I have to get done and when is it all going to happen. So it's actually also the process of doing that is bringing me to a place of calm to start my day with the mindset of being ready for what I have ahead.
Here's the interesting question. If I told you you had to do it in the evening, how would you feel?
Oh, I wouldn't like that. I mean, I would do it if I had to, but I wouldn't like it.
When people mess with our rituals, we don't like it. Now, I could argue it works just as well as a planning ritual the night before as the morning of. But as an emotional preparation for the day or as a way to get into the zone, it doesn't work nearly as well the night before as the morning of. So it's a beautiful example that we look at things in the world of work and we go, yeah, it's a little thing. But in fact, so many of the little things are actually really big things when it comes to our emotional health and psychological stability.
Yes. And when you're navigating the constant changes, these rituals are that stable ground as you've described. And I love that it's not just about the practice itself, but as you're saying, the emotional regulation. And when we're in times of change, that's high anxiety, high stress. And these are the things that can keep us calm and consistent and focused. So I love this. All right. We are running out of time though. So Ashley, can you tell us about a great manager that you worked for and what made this person such a fabulous boss?
We haven't talked very much about making space for people, which is another wonderful thing that managers, team leaders can do to give people stability. Because if I've got space to do my thing, then I have some, I have more control, I have more agency. And so I have more of the positive emotional, psychological reality that comes from feeling I'm in control. I had a manager way back in the early 20-teens, we'll say, at Deloitte called Diana O'Brien. And Diana was marvelous because Diana gave me all sorts of space. And so I'll give you an example. There was a project at Deloitte to reinvent how we did performance ratings. And Diana came to me and said, "You have been complaining about performance ratings louder than anyone else for the longest amount of time, so you're in charge. Go." And she didn't say, "Do it like this," or "Do it like this," or "The outcome must be this." She said, you really care about this thing, so I'm putting you in charge." And I said, "Well, what will your higher-ups think?" And she said, "Don't worry. I told them that you're in charge, and they trust me, so you're in charge." And what she then did was to continue to give me all sorts of space to figure out what I thought the best way through was, while also sort of protecting me from organizational interference. Because if you're going to rethink something, if you're going to, now this is real innovation, this is ground up innovation, if you like, if you're actually going to come up with improvement, then you need a little space to figure things out. And if everybody wants to show up every day and tell you what you're doing wrong, or tell you why you annoyed them this thing, and the thing that you said doesn't make any sense, and how on earth is that going to work anyway, then you don't get very far. And so the other thing that Diana did was she said, "Send those people to me." And I would say, "Go talk to Diana," and she would, some conversation would happen and I would never hear about it again. There's a wonderful sort of manager team leader who says, "Look, daylight is this. This is where we need to go. Will you take us there?" And then gives you space. And then keeps the judgment and the interfering and the complaints and the, which is not to say that everyone's perfect, and not to say I probably didn't do a bunch of stuff that was genuinely annoying to other people. But you can let all of that stuff shut somebody down. You can let all of that stuff freeze somebody in place. And so Diana protected me from all of those things. And that led to, by the way, a wholly new performance management system. Deloitte abandoned doing annual ratings, annual performance reviews, went to weekly check-ins, and completely changed its attitude to how to get the best out of people at work. So it was not, it was a project not without consequence for 70,000 people, I think.
Wow. Amazing. And what a gift to have someone who can really give you that space and protect you from the whirlwind that often comes.
I can remember the conversation where she said, "I'm putting you in charge." And the first thing I wanted to say, and it's a good job I didn't, the first thing I wanted to say was, "Are you kidding me?" I was like, Christmas had come early. I couldn't believe I was going to be put in charge of this thing. Wow. It was such a statement of trust and faith and confidence. Made me feel like $1 million and made me really want to do it brilliantly well. Making space signals trust too, and that's a super powerful thing. That was Diana's story.
Thank you for sharing that. And where can people learn more about you? Tell us the name of your book and where we can find it, all that jazz.
So the book is available wherever books are sold, and people can find out more about me on my website, which is, I think, somewhat ingeniously named ashleygoodall.com. So there's all sorts of stuff about this book, about my other books and writings, and about who I am and what I do that folks can find there.
Fabulous. What's the name of this book?
This book is called The Problem with Change, which I think is a good name given the conversation we've just had.
I agree. Well, thank you again, Ashley. Really a pleasure to chat with you. I feel like there's so much more we could have gotten to, but we ran out of time. So thank you again.
Thank you.
Ashley is providing members of Podcast Plus a 10% discount on his book, The Problem with Change. Drawing on 2 decades spent leading HR organizations at Deloitte and Cisco, in this book, Ashley reveals the truth about human performance and offers a radical new alternative to the constant turbulence that defines corporate life. To get this guest bonus, the extended interview, episode guide, and many more membership resources, become a member at themodernmanager.com/more. All the links are in the show notes, and they can be delivered to your inbox when you subscribe to my newsletter. Find that at themodernmanager.com. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.